Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A little later in the hour, we'll put higher education in the state in the spotlight when we have a live conversation with University of Northern Iowa President Mark Nook. He's just over a year in his office as president of the university in Cedar Falls. We'll ask about his views on the cuts in funding, the rising tuition, rising fees for students, also student debt, among other things. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps email us right now with your question about higher education, the future of it in Iowa, or a personal experience. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. My first guest this hour is State Senator Chip Baltimore. He's a Republican from Boone. Baltimore has served four terms in office for House District 47. Back in March, he announced that he would not be seeking re-election. Chip Baltimore, welcome to the program.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
This is a be an interesting conversation to have you talk a little bit about your time in the House here in Iowa. Tell us why you're not seeking a fifth term.
Well, I think there's a multiple reasons for that. You know, I think the main thing is when I look back at when I decided to run back in 2010, there were a number of priorities that I had that I thought that we needed to do better at as a state, and I think we've accomplished, you know, many of those, if not most of them. And so it's just one of those situations, times in life when it's like, you know, I've got a lot of other things I'd like to do. This job takes a ton of time, not just during the session, but also, you know, in the off season, and you know, it's just a good time. I think we did accomplish almost everything that I thought was necessary to work on, and so I thought it would just be a good time to retire and let someone else take up the flag on that.
Representative Baltimore, you were arrested in Ames in January, charged with a first offense OWI, and also possession of carrying a dangerous weapon while under the influence.
I heard about that.
Yeah, and you were very forthright. You came on this program, I think it was just days afterwards, and spoke about it. Mm-hmm. You were sentenced. You pled guilty. You were sentenced to 2 years of probation. Also removed from your position as chair of the House Judiciary Committee. I mean, just looking at the lineup of events, it's hard to figure if any of us would put ourselves in your shoes that didn't figure into your decision not to seek re-election.
Well, why would it?
Well, because it would make re-election difficult as with that conviction, wouldn't
you know
it?
What? No, it really wouldn't. And I don't think it would based upon, you know, the conversations I've had with people in my district, the people in my district, and really people all over the state were incredibly supportive of me and the bad decision that I made. Not supportive of the bad decision, obviously,
right.
But
right.
But they were supportive of me and very forgiving of that. And I'm talking Republicans, Democrats, Independents. It really didn't matter. I got some wonderfully compassionate, touching messages from people that politically would not generally be inclined to support me. But you know, first of all, I don't think it would have been difficult to win re-election in my district. Mm-hmm. You know, I won by 23 points in, you know, 2 years ago, just 2 years ago. I don't think that's the kind of margin that is going to be frittered away by that bad decision, especially given the support and comments that I've received from people in the district. But when you look back at the last couple of years, you know, my decision to not run again was primarily made after the 2016 election, and I was kind of waiting to announce, to decide, you know, see if anything would change my mind, and nothing really did. One of the most obvious signs that's out there publicly that I had made that decision already, and that the arrest and that sort of thing didn't have anything to do with it, was the parade schedule from last year. I didn't participate in any parades mm-hmm. in 2017. I did not do much in the way of fundraising. And that was all prior to that arrest. So I'd already made some life choices about some things I wanted to do going forward, and so that decision was made. And while it may be public media fodder to try to blame my decision to
I'm
not saying you, but for people to believe that it was simply something that was not a factor in it.
I think people would be wondering, what kind of political career do you have in your future, or is this the end of it?
Who knows? I really don't know.
You can't offer any thoughts about whether you have a political career in the future.
If I decide to run for some office, I certainly am not afraid to run for an office. I wasn't planning on running for this back in 2010. Simply an opportunity that came up through some rather strange circumstances, and I decided to do it then. It was never one of those things where I decided or I thought early on that, politics is my thing. So, I don't foreclose anything, but I certainly don't see any position out there that I'm itching to try to run for at this point. Mm-hmm.
If you just joined us, Chip Baltimore is my guest, a Republican state representative, spent 5 years as the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and will not be seeking a re-election come November. When you're out of office, perhaps you can't answer that at this point, but we've seen politicians at a national level be able to, it seems, speak their minds in a freer way. Do you think that will be your case? I mean, you have in a number of cases, and I want to talk about it too, spoke out against ideas you didn't believe in, even when they were backed by your own party.
Well, Ben, I think if you followed my career in the House, I've always tried to speak bluntly and candidly about what I think and why I think it. Sometimes to the detriment of my own party at times, but I am who I am, and I'm going to tell you what I think. It doesn't matter whether I'm running for office or whether I'm in office or whether I'm not in office, and I think that that's one of the things that it's most frustrating for average, ordinary folks out there is when politicians talk political speak instead of just talking and saying what they think. So I've never taken that really as my approach. So I don't feel any freer now that I'm on the way out of office to speak bluntly, because I did it all the time when I was in office.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the few times, at least a couple of times, that you parted ways with your with your party. You went against most of your GOP colleagues and voted nay against the so-called fetal heartbeat bill, which passed into law. Now a judge in the meantime has placed a temporary injunction on the heartbeat law, which received a lot of national publicity as one of the most restrictive abortion measures in the country. It bans nearly all abortions once a fetal heartbeat can be detected. That's about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Was slated to take effect July 1st, but as I said, a judge placing a temporary injunction on that. Why did you vote against this?
Well, there's a number of reasons, but I think a couple of the main ones that I can easily talk about. Number one, I think that there's a difference between morality and government, and while I truly do believe that life does begin at the time of conception, and that every life is precious, I think that's at times more of a moral judgment than it is a governmental one. But I think the main reason that I struggled with supporting that is because I think strategically it was just very, very poorly done. I think it was poor strategy. Just last year we passed the 20-week ban, which said that you can't get an abortion after the baby is 20 weeks of along in the gestation process.
Which you supported.
I did support that, and I think that was a good thing. From this perspective, and you have to understand that you know, I'm a lawyer. You know, my background is in the law. The proponents of this bill planned it to be a challenge to Roe versus Wade, and they wanted to get this bill before the U.S. Supreme Court to challenge Roe versus Wade, which established the right to an abortion back in 1973. This bill, and I think, you know, the facts have borne this out now, this bill was definitely going to be challenged, but it was never going to be challenged under the U.S. Constitution. It was going to be challenged under the Iowa Constitution. And so this bill really, in my opinion, at the time that we voted on it, I did not believe that this bill would ever be a challenge to Roe versus Wade. So I think that was strategically poor in terms of trying to believe that. I think it's just an erroneous opinion that was ever going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think that the current makeup of the Iowa Supreme Court is likely to give abortion opponents a worse case scenario than what they currently have. I think that what you're likely to find after the Iowa Supreme Court looks at the fetal heartbeat bill is that I think you're going to find an Iowa Constitution-based Roe versus Wade decision that establishes, under the Iowa Constitution, a woman's right to have an abortion. And I think that's exactly not what the bill proponents wanted. So I think strategically it was poorly done in that regard. And I think the last point on it, and again, this is from a legal perspective, is I don't think that either the U.S. Supreme Court or the Iowa Supreme Court are really going to go away from using viability of the baby to live outside of the mother's womb as the real legal standard in terms of that's the threshold that you have to get past before an abortion will be banned. I think that we've come now 45 years of women having a right to an abortion at some stage. And I think that from a legal perspective, I think that the judicial system and the courts are unlikely to drift far from mm-hmm. the viability date in terms of whether you can or can't have an abortion. And I think that the fetal heartbeat bill clearly is not a proxy for viability. So from a legal perspective, I just think that it was poorly conceived. I think it was poorly strategized, and I think at the end of the day, the abortion opponents in this state that really wanted this bill are going to be dramatically disappointed because I think they're going to get something that is far worse than what they have now. Mm-hmm. How's that for an answer?
That was in depth, and what I would expect from the former chair of the House Judiciary Committee, a graduate, I guess, of the University of Minnesota Law School, also yes. of ISU as well. So thanks for that analysis. It saved a follow-up or two. Thank you. Let's talk about water quality, because that's another issue. Right. The new law from this past session pours some $282 million over a dozen years into water quality. The governor, Kim Reynolds, hailed it as a victory. But you accused your own leadership of the GOP leadership of caving to political interests. What is wrong with our new water quality legislation?
Well, it's never going to be big enough to solve the problem. Never. Yeah, it's $282 million over a dozen years. Big deal. You know, it's a drop in the bucket. You know, according to the nutrient reduction strategy, I think it's going to take between $4 to $6 billion to see some dramatic, you know, measurable improvement in water quality in this state. You know, $282 million doesn't begin to touch it. Number one, so size wise, it wasn't enough. But the House bill that I floor managed wasn't big enough either. But in my opinion, and again, this is from a legislative policy perspective. In my opinion, when you're doing something like this, it's most important at the onset to get the structure of the program and the policy correct before you just dump a bunch of money into it. Just dumping a bunch of money at a problem without an underlying structure doesn't get it done. And when we look at the bill that that passed, what that did primarily was just throw a bunch of money into the Department of Agriculture and say, here, throw out some cost share grants. You know, the taxpayers will now will pay half of whatever Farmer Brown's water quality project on his little farm he wants to do. And Farmer Brown's got to put up the other half, and they do it kind of piecemeal, one little project at a time. I think that that's short-sighted, number one. You know, the House bill that, that we worked on that got huge bipartisan support, I think it was, what, you know, 81 to 17 that passed in the 2017 session. The House bill was set up so that all of the relevant players in a watershed, not one farm at a time, but in a watershed, would get together and they would, first of all, identify what their problems were. Second of all, identify what the solutions to those problems would be in the watershed. And third, they would come up with a way to pay for it. And so what that would do was would require all of the people to sit down together, talk to each other, and realize that this is not an urban versus rural problem. It is an Iowa problem or a watershed problem. And so cities would go out, and if a city had a problem with, you know, nitrates in their drinking water, they would do a watershed study. They'd go out and identify what's the best way to address that problem. Should they just, you know, take a look at updating or improving their water treatment system? Well, maybe. But maybe they can decide that, that there's some areas out in the watershed where the nitrates are coming into the water supply at a higher level. So maybe they want to go out and go out into the rural areas and try to create some improvements out there to keep the nitrates lower before they ever get to the water treatment plant. So under the House bill, the city could have then gone out and helped pay for some of those projects, you know, out in the rural areas, using, you know, either cost share grants or some bonding that we had out there at some very low cost subsidized bonding that would have allowed the cities to go out and pay for some of those rural projects. It was much more collaborative in nature. It was more holistic in terms of addressing those problems.
In the interest of time, do you think we'll get there sometime?
No. Well, not anytime soon, because I think that the powers that be have decided that the bill that was just passed is the end-all be-all. Now, they're going to tell you that they're going to keep working on it, but they're going to tinker around the edges because this is the structure that they decided upon. Mm-hmm. And so now I think what you're going to see is we just need more money into what I consider to be a faulty structure.
Okay, so many things that I would love to talk to you about, but we have just 5 minutes left. I wanted to get to this question from Bill in Sac City. He asked this question, Representative Baltimore, does the uncompromising and hardline makeup of the legislature dissuade the type of people that would we would really want in the legislature from running for state office? Should this be the case? Is this why we are seeing dramatic cuts to education at all levels? Asks Bill from Sac City.
Well, I don't think that you're seeing dramatic cuts to education at all levels. If you look back at the funding for K through 12 education in this state since 2011, you know, Iowa ranks number 4 in the country in terms of growth of funding at that level, and to the tune of $700 and some odd million additional money a year with that. But I think that that we're seeing an increased polarization out there, particularly from the extremes of both parties. There tends to be a cry for purists, you know, in a party. If you don't support all of the planks of all of your party's platforms, then, you know, you're not a real Republican, you're not a real Democrat, and I think that that's a shame. I think that
have you been accused of that?
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. I don't know that anybody out there
that probably hasn't. Was it part of your reason for not running for re-election?
Oh, good grief, no. I mean, look, people elected me because I do speak out in part, and I do state my mind. And when they ask me why I didn't support whatever it might happen to be that might be the party position, I explain it, much as I've done on this program. So, and I think that those are the conversations that need to be had when you actually talk to people instead of talk at people. But you talk to them, you listen to them, and you have this kind of discussion. You know, they understand and they appreciate it.
Well, what about cuts to higher education? We'll be having the president of UNI on after we're finished talking with you. Dramatic cuts there, and with the isn't it true with the tax cuts that were enacted this past session, it doesn't bode well for the future for supporting higher education, or have I got that wrong?
Well, you know, higher education costs have gone out of control. You know, we were there for a while, for a long time. We were seeing double-digit increases in tuition costs and just funding, period, in terms of what it costs to run these state universities. You know, Iowa has three publicly funded universities. Show me another state with 3.3 million people that has three publicly funded universities in it and tries to get state support for all three. And they do get huge state support for all three. You know, I think that the business model of those universities needs to be relooked at. You know, do we need each of those three universities offering the same program? We've got a lot of duplication of programs in those three universities, and they all have different features and different attributes to them, and I understand that. But you know, it's becoming increasingly expensive to support three publicly funded universities in the state of Iowa. And I think that's more along the lines of what you see in terms of why it's a budgetary problem than it is a lack of a priority.
Okay. Oh, we've run out of time. Thank you very much for offering your insights. Chip Baltimore, Republican state representative, and will be finishing up his fourth term at his last session here. What not related to any sort of politics do you have planned in the future, Chip Baltimore?
Well, I'm looking at a lot of different opportunities, you know, in the private sector, and you know, obviously I still have a job. I'd like to put some more attention to, you know, back in Boone. So we're just looking around to see what opportunities are out there, and just trying to go on about the job of living life.
All right, Chip Baltimore, thanks for coming into our studio.
My pleasure, Ben. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. When we come back, we'll be joined by the president of the University of Northern Iowa, Mark Nook. He's been in that office for just over a year. We'll ask his views on the cuts in funding, also the rising tuition and fees, and the situation with rising student debt for our public university students. Back in just a moment with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.